This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
December 2018, the hard-traveling fanboys are celebrating Aquaman Month.
In 1941, the Allied forces invaded Normandy. No, I'm just kidding. How's it going, everyone? We are the hard-traveling fanboys. And we're here to you to continue our streak of being the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Hey, I say if the Allies, you know, the Allies are at war right now, I say, Greg, that we surrender to the Germans right away.
And listen to what that Hitler has to say?
Yeah, I think so.
There's no way we can beat them anyway.
That's right.
little Artie Kendall action here on Hard Travel Fanboys. Google him, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Artie Kendall, the late night crooner.
Mm-hmm.
We are here tonight to kick off another gimmick month.
Gimmick months, we love them.
We love gimmick months here in the L-shaped studio in Ho Ho Loon Plaza in serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Indeed. We are kicking off Aquaman Month.
Aquamonth.
Mm-hmm. Here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Because as everyone knows, later this month, the theatrical premiere nationwide of Aquaman, directed by James Wan, will kick off around the globe, and we are going to be right here at the Hard Traveling Studios to give you our thoughts on that film once it has both been released and we have seen it. And in the meantime, we're going to dedicate an entire month to DC Comics' King of the Seven Seas, none other than Arthur Curry himself, a character who has a rich and luxurious history going all the way back to More Fun Comics number 73 from November of 1941, Nick. Mm. So we've got over a half century of character to delve into here. And to kick things off, we're going to take you fellas and ladies, off the page, because we are going to venture into the DC animated universe. To be more specific, the DC animated movie universe. Mm-hmm. we are going to be taking a look at a film adaptation from 2015 of the modern classic, Geoff Johns written Aquaman story, Throne of Atlantis. In this case, the movie is called Justice League Throne of Atlantis because they figured Aquaman wouldn't move enough copies. So here it is. We have actually, back in our old days of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, I don't know if you remember this, Nick, we actually reviewed the trade of Throne of Atlantis for a Longbook Hunters edition. And our thoughts on that book were that it was awesome.
Yes, and it is. We stand by that. The comic book version of this story is fantastic.
Fantastic. A great story. One of the greats in Aquaman's pantheon, at least from what I've encountered. And also, one might argue, the beginning of the high water mark for Geoff Johns Justice League run. Huh? High water.
I see what you did there.
Because it's Aquaman. And much like Aqua, I'm a Barbie girl in a Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic.
Hmm.
You see, there was a band called Aqua.
I got that.
And they did the song Barbie Girl, came out when I was in middle school and you were in diapers, shitting in your britches every morning. In any event, Justice League Throne of Atlantis. So you might think that you know, obviously it's an adaptation of a popular DC Comics story, so maybe it's in the vein of something like a Batman Year One or a Dark Knight Returns, something that's a standalone adaptation of that story. Does that make sense, Nick?
I'm sorry, rephrase the question again. I'm trying to understand your question.
Well, I think when someone is looking at this from the outside, you might think they are doing an adaptation. Well, they decided with the creation of this animated universe and the Flashpoint Paradox, which I believe came out in, let me double check this, 2013, so about two years before this movie came out in Throne of Atlantis, they decided, hey, the New 52 had just come out in 2011 and had restarted the DC universe out of the event called Flashpoint. So they decided, the decision makers here, James Tucker and company, to start a, quote, animated universe of original standalone movies that were all tied together, serial storytelling, basically, with the Flashpoint Paradox. That led into Justice League War, which was an adaptation of Geoff Johns and Jim Lee's very first story in the New 52. And this whole universe was built around the designs, the characterizations, and the story of the then-contemporary New 52. Well, I'm sure, as we're going to get into here a little bit, when they started this new universe, the thought was that the New 52, as of 2013, had been very successful sales-wise, if not critically. It had been successful commercially. And the thought was these were changes that were going to stick. All these characterizations were going to be long-term, you know, a post-crisis style reboot of the DCU. Of course, we all know that things did not turn out that way. The reaction to the New 52 from longtime DC readers was largely negative in a lot of aspects. Many of the books that started out good lost steam along the way. And by 2015, when Throne of Atlantis comes out, we were already starting to see a little bit of backtracking on some of these characterizations. And fast forward to today, 2018, and virtually all of the New 52 redesigns have been done away with. Mm-hmm. Many of the New 52 characterizations have been done away with or altered. And we've seen a very much of a return to the pre-Flashpoint characterizations or even the introduction of new characterizations on top of the old ones. So building an animated universe on that brand new, arguably shaky foundation was interesting to begin with, Nick. Would you agree?
Yeah, it was certainly an interesting move. This was kind of around the time that it felt like the big wigs at DC were going all in on the New 52, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. Whether it was even down to something like merchandising. I remember walking around Target, and there was the big like push for Cyborg merchandise at the time because they wanted Cyborg to be seen as a founding member of the Justice League as he was being portrayed in the New 52. Toys were being swapped out, you know, to match New 52 incarnation. So everything, mm-hmm, I think they wanted to fall in line and attempt to present a more unified front so that when you saw anything DC related here at this point, I think they kind of wanted you to see the New 52 version. And it stands to reason that, unfortunately, the animated films would have to fall into that strategy as well.
So what we saw with this new approach to a connected animated universe was we saw a uniformity of animated style that we had not seen since the Bruce Timm-verse. And if you look at something like Superman, Batman, Public Enemies, if you recall, it was an adaptation of an existing work where they tried to mimic Ed McGuinness's character designs from the book. But when they did Apocalypse, it was a different artist, Michael Turner, who did the book, and so they changed the art and the animation style. Well, with this, they're going for a uniform look across the board, uniform character designs, uniform animation style in all these movies. So while this does create a consistency in tone across each of these films that we see progressively moving along, it also locks it in place. So if you're not a fan of that animated style, there's pretty much nothing you can do about it. It's pretty much, you know, you're stuck with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's perhaps a good place to start on this film, is this animated style, which I would describe as maybe a marriage of the Bruce Timm traditional, what we've come to expect from DC animation, mm-hmm. along with a few of the anime influenced yes. concepts that were introduced in the Flashpoint Paradox, perhaps yes. not to that extreme. And the result is a style that, while I would not say that this is a bad animation style by any means, it is an animation style that I have to say, Nick, leaves me wanting in terms yes. of the character designs and in particular the way people talk, I guess. They just it's not as fluid as I'm used to seeing from DC animation.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I mean, you mentioned that it's kind of a marriage between the Bruce Timm style and the anime and some anime influences. And I would argue that by trying to serve both of those, it, mm-hmm. it fails both. You called out, you said the Flashpoint Paradox was a bit more direct in its anime influences. And I would argue the animation in the Flashpoint Paradox is much better than what we see here.
Yes.
And I think that this is just an unfortunate attempt to trod a middle road. And yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the animation in this one pretty much throughout, especially as it related to facial features and any time mm-hmm. anybody spoke.
Yes, the facial expressions suffer in some of the same ways that I think some of the lesser Americanized anime do, in terms of the facial expressions don't feel genuine. They're trying to make you feel genuine. Sorry, I've gotten used to it because I've watched most DC animated films now, but like it's still a little bit jarring to see an animated form these new 52 redesigns, some of which were fine and some of which are a little more out there than we would like.
Yeah, the Superman design, I think, was one that most people are aware of the controversy surrounding it from the new 52 era. And it's not great, I'll put it that way, but this movie reminded me how much I hate that Wonder Woman look that they went with for this animated universe. I don't remember this necessarily being the exact look from the New 52 era of comics, but perhaps I'm wrong. But no, this look for Wonder Woman that's more of a, she's got this weird bodysuit thing that stretches up to her neck. Not a fan at all. Even Green Lantern's costume, which should be hard to mess up, is a bit overcomplicated for my taste, but with the
yes,
green lines running all over it and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. Just everything about this.
Batman doesn't need to have lines drawn all over his costume. It's fine. I mean, Batman is almost impossible to screw up. Not impossible, le bossu, but almost impossible to screw up visually. But you know, you look at someone like the Flash. I've constantly complained about his new 52 costume having the yellow lines all over his suit. I don't like it. Never have liked it. Green Lantern does not need to have armor or look to be made to look like he has armored plating everywhere. Don't like that. Superman's armor, didn't like that. So yeah, they are fighting a little bit of an uphill battle with perception, and at least in my opinion, for longtime fans with some of these costumes. As far as permanent changes, but that's not the main crux of this film. That's just sort of something that sticks with all of them. I will say, also from the visual standpoint, I think I had no issues with the action in this movie. I thought the action scenes were pretty well done. Not the best that I've seen, certainly. In some of the pre-New 52 animated films, I've seen better action scenes, but there was good stuff here. The underwater action was good. Mira's stuff was good.
Mira in general was the best part of this movie, like
I agree.
By far.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Yes. Well, yeah, the two things that stand out to me about this movie were Mira and one of the best Green Lantern scenes in any of these movies, which is Hal turning himself into a giant vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, that was
and sucking up that the different Atlantean soldiers. That was really cool and inventive and something. You know, we've talked about in the past that Green Lantern is a character that visually opens itself up to so many possibilities, and I love seeing animators think outside the box like that. That was really cool. So yeah, I agree. Mira and that were standouts. But let's get to the crux of this movie, because as we hinted at the beginning of this episode, Throne of Atlantis movie is actually not a direct adaptation of the Geoff Johns Throne of Atlantis. It is instead a loose adaptation of the first three volumes of Geoff Johns' classic New 52 Aquaman run. to this point, and here's the other aspect, because they made the creative decision in Justice League War to use Shazam instead of Aquaman, we as an audience have not been introduced to Aquaman yet. So Throne of Atlantis has to do – it already is working at a disadvantage, because instead of being able to just tell the story of Throne of Atlantis, they also have to give us the origin of Aquaman, because they've not done that yet. So they have to tell us who Arthur Curry is, tell us who Queen Atlanta is, tell us who Arthur's dad is, show us his upbringing, give us a reason to care about him, show us who Mira is, show us what Atlanta is and how it operates, introduce us to Orm. They also decide to introduce us to the Trench, a group of characters introduced in the second volume of, the opening volume of John's Aquaman. They also have to introduce us to Black Manta. Well, they don't have to, but they choose to introduce us to Black Manta. They also want to hit upon some of the New 52, because it is a Justice League movie, remember, not just an Aquaman movie. So they also have to somehow give us subplots with the Justice League, which means we get the controversial Superman Wonder Woman romance here.
Ugh.
We get the we get another subplot involving Cyborg trying to come to terms with his humanity, which works better than the Superman subplot does. But still, the point that I'm making here is I've just named off what, Nick, 8 different story points. Something like that?
Yes. And let's not forget that, Throne of Atlantis in and of itself, even if you were just adapting that one story, it's a fairly dense story that has a few different subplots running throughout it. So there was plenty of material there for 72 minutes. But when you add in all these other things that Greg is referencing, plus having to serve as an origin story for Aquaman,
you run out of real estate.
As with many of these DC animated movies, you run out of real estate.
Yeah, and it's very unfortunate, because all of the stories that they're adapting, those first 3 volumes of Geoff Johns Aquaman, are exceptional. They are great comic books. That era of Justice League are great comic books that are setting up this Throne of Atlantis story, which ran between Aquaman and Justice League books. But I think going back to the decision to not use Aquaman in Justice League War, it hamstrung them in that regard, and I still don't understand it, Nick. Their inexplicable marriage to that 70 to 72 minute runtime, whatever reason it is, budgetary or otherwise, it hamstrings you creatively, and now you have to fit all of this story in. And because it's an Aquaman movie, you want to use Black Manta. So you feel like you have to shoehorn him in, but you only have so much time. So as a result, they have to take what I would consider to be some egregious storytelling shortcuts and character shortcuts. Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Nick?
Absolutely, I would agree. And really, you have to do these things, especially with, characters like you mentioned, like Black Manta, and like, most notably for me, Ocean Master, Orm, a character who had so much nuance and was so much more than just a generic evil mustache-twirling villain in the original Throne of Atlantis comic. And here, they pretty much reduce him in every way imaginable into this caricature of what I imagine the old Silver Age Ocean Master was like.
Exactly. Yeah, so in the actual Throne of Atlantis book, we talked about this. Maybe the best part of that story is Ocean Master, a character who I had never cared at all about in my life of reading comics, and yet, or even watching cartoons. I had never cared about him, but the comic made me care about him because it made him into a villain that is so sympathetic that he's really not a villain. You can't even consider him. We talked about this when we reviewed it. We didn't even consider him a villain because every action he takes is justifiable in the book. Now, in the movie, he's just a straight-up villain. He's a whiny little punk-ass villain who has no redeeming qualities about him whatsoever. He's a coward. He's a liar. He's a schemer. His father was a drinker and a fiend. and there's just nothing redeeming about him. To the point where you mentioned him earlier, and this is not as egregious quite as Ocean Master, but Black Manta is turned from a mercenary who's got, you know, objectives all of his own to someone who lives in Atlantis, works in Atlantis, is the right-hand man of King Orm, and other than a throwaway line near the end of the movie where he says, oh, I've got my own motivations, we don't ever find out what his motivations are because he is essentially, for most of this movie, just doing the bidding of King Orm. And anybody that's ever encountered Black Manta knows that is about as far from him as it gets.
Right.
He is not somebody who's sitting here trying to put Ocean Master on the throne. He's not somebody that's going to get eaten by a freaking killer whale almost as soon as he confronts Aquaman. Sorry, yes. Spoiler alert. They completely missed the point of Black Manta,
and they try to pay like
trying to get him in the movie,
and they try to pay lip service to it there at the end with a throwaway line of like, yep. Oh, all of this was my doing, even and then 30 like you said, 30 seconds later he's eaten by a giant. I thought it was a shark, but it could
have been a shark, a whale know. Shark, whatever. And it's not it's a waste of a great character in Black Manta, one of the, you know, easily the most iconic Aquaman villain. They waste to try to fit him in this movie. Meanwhile, Ocean Master, the guy that you're sacrificing Black Manta for, essentially, is also wasted because you've removed the nuance of his character and you're left with a hollow Silver Age villain in a movie that is trying to be gritty and modern and realistic as superhero content goes. Because we've got emotionally complex heroes and a cardboard villain.
Pretty much. A series of cardboard villains, whether it's, like you said, Ocean Master or Black Manta or, you know, whoever else that are following along with them. But mm-hmm. In addition to all that, you've also got, like we said, just these things that are rushed through. Like, we actually see, in the modern context, Atlanta, Aquaman's mother, sitting on the throne of Atlantis. We see, you know, her murder. We, you know, it's just, there's so much mm-hmm. here that is burned through at such a rapid pace that it just kind of... And it's weird because it suffers from the same issues that a lot of these DC animated movies suffer from. It's not that the pace is constantly go, 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 and it moves too quickly. This movie chooses to slow down at times, but it chooses to slow down in all the wrong places. We didn't need Greg, for example. I mean, it was a good half hour before the entire Justice League was back on the screen together. Like, and this is supposed to be
had to establish that the Justice League didn't like working together, even though they just do.
Right.
There's no conversation when they get back together saying, hey, we, you know, why don't we get together more often? They just do it. And it's a waste of real estate, again.
So, yeah. One thing I wanted to touch on, you know, I don't think we've ever actually, have we ever reviewed Justice League War for our column or anything?
I don't think so. Maybe. I don't think so, though.
It's been a long time since I've seen Justice League War. Probably haven't seen it since it was first released. And watching this reminded me of something that I had forgotten. Good Lord, do I hate the voice actor playing Batman in these DC animated movies. I think he's atrocious. I think he's one of the worst Batman voice actors I've heard, honestly.
What about him?
Just the way he pronounces things, it comes off sounding overly stilted. At times, I don't find his voice to have the appropriate level of intimidation behind it. It just kind of comes off... I don't buy it, I guess is the best way I can put it. Mm. Jason O'Mara is the guy doing the voice, and I kind
of
hate
took it. It took me a while to grow on him a couple of movies. This movie, he didn't stand out one way or the other to me. I think he's gotten better since then, but I can see where you're going. I've had the same problem with Superman's voice actor, Jerry O'Connell. Now, I just talked on our show not long ago about how great he is in Death of Superman, and he is. But it's the first time he's been great. Because in this, like, to your point about Batman having to have a certain intimidating tone about him, Superman needs to have a commanding tone about him. And I feel like O'Connell's Superman in both Justice League War and in this movie comes off as more of a... almost a boyish Superman, mm-hmm. More of a Shazam than a Superman, if that makes sense. And for me, he never quite just commanded me the way that, and part of that is the New 52 characterization, which was going for a younger Superman. But I think part of it also comes down to, you either have it or you don't. Like George Newbern, you know, that classic Justice League Superman voice actor, or Tim Daly from the solo animated movie series and some of the other movies. They have that Superman voice that comes off as both innocent farm boy and also commanding presence when he needs to be. And he's lacking that here. I think Rosario Dawson, I think, does the voice of Wonder Woman, and she's good. I thought Flash and of course Nathan Fillion's awesome as Hal Jordan. He's some of his dialogue you could argue is not good for Hal Jordan, but his tone I think is perfect for Hal. He's got that sort of cockiness that you look for. The Flash, I can't remember who does the voice of the Flash. I'll look it up right here, but he does a good job, I think. He's one of the better ones in the movie. Yeah, so it's Christopher Gorham does the voice of Barry Allen and does a good job. And the other voice actors in here, they're all right. You know, Juliet Landau's Lois Lane is fine. Shamar Moore does a good job as Cyborg, too. I want to shout him out. He's real good. And actually, Cyborg in general has been one of the better parts of these animated movies. And somebody named Suma Lee Montano does Mira, and she's, as you mentioned, Nick, she's probably the star of the movie in terms of standing out from the crowd.
Yeah, I would agree.
So we also get a brief cameo here in this movie from John Henry Irons, who we won't see again, to my knowledge, until Death of Superman, where he plays a bigger role. Anything voice cast wise you wanted to shout out, Nick?
No, other than the fact that their Batman sucks. No, the rest is what it is.
So they blow through a lot of story here. They blow through a lot of they waste a lot of opportunities here with some of these characters and their characterizations. Let's hit the other elephant in the room, Nick. Boy, did I hate the Superman and Wonder Woman subplot.
Yeah, I mean, but we hated it when it happened in the New 52. Like, it's
absolutely
not, you know,
it's
just
something that we love Geoff Johns. He can do no wrong in our eyes, but in this case, we aren't second guessing. We first guessed it.
Yep.
You know, it's something that I was okay with exploring the concept of at the time, just to show why it wouldn't work. I didn't expect it to last like a year and a half or 2 years or whatever it lasted. And it just doesn't work. It's a dynamic that doesn't work for me. It's never going to work for me. And it especially doesn't work here because it seemingly comes out of nowhere.
Right.
They just start kissing and going out on dates. And it's like, you know, there's not really a build to it because they don't have time to build to it.
They start kissing, going out on dates, and having awkward confrontations with Lois Lane.
Yes, yes. Which did nothing but make Lois look pathetic. And,
yep.
Just not good, doesn't work, unnecessary, didn't like that subplot at all. Cyborg stuff's pretty good here, like that.
Yep.
The other big problem with the movie, I mentioned all the stuff with Flash, Green Lantern is fine, Shazam's good, the Atlantis stuff is good for the most part outside of Orm, but the other big problem with this movie, and you may or may not disagree with me on this, but I didn't find the movie or the voice acting to do a good enough job of making me care about Arthur. Mainly because I thought his character arc was just too fast for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he goes from a guy who's slumming around, you know, clearly nowhere to go in life, a loser, to suddenly he's fighting off armed Atlantean guards, to suddenly he's just accepting that Atlantis exists, going down there with no real fight against Mira. And then he goes on the hero's journey and falls in love with and gets Mira to fall in love with him. And it all moves so quickly that I didn't buy it. I did not buy his journey at all. And it didn't give me a chance to emotionally connect with him in any real way. I didn't feel like he cared about his mother dying because he had never met her. And, you know, even though it's there and it's a plot point in the movie, I didn't feel it, and I didn't feel anything with him and Orm. I didn't think there was any, you know, natural enmity there. It was just Very forced, I guess, is how I would describe it.
Yeah, I would agree that I would agree with that as well. It just all felt very sudden, and it was weird to take the story move of okay, you know, you're going through all this development very quickly, and you have Atlanta still alive, but you don't even bother to give us that even like a 30-second scene of those two reuniting before having Orm, you know, pull that away from him. That would have at least provided some more character motivation, but here, mm-hmm. Orm kills Atlanta before he ever has the chance to meet her, and he just shows up, and now he is all in on leading the people of Atlantis, a thing he barely knew existed, you know, the day before. It's just everything about it, the way this movie is paced and plotted, is problematic for me.
And Orm, who has never commanded the Trident, not only commands it instantly, but overpowers the entire Justice League. By himself.
Yep. And yep. That was really dumb. Cocoons. That was really dumb. It felt like some of those early Justice League television show episodes where Superman just went flying off screen and that was it.
Yeah. Or like a World War II plane shoots him and he finally just gets tired of flying and collapses in a heap. Sort of like Professor Xavier trying to use his powers on the X-Men series. Anyway, oh boy. So I don't know, man. It's a bummer to kick off Aquaman month with a negative review. That's really not what this is about. This is about celebrating Aquaman and what makes him an awesome character, despite what you may have heard through jokes or through history and everything like that. That Aquaman is really a great character that has a lot of great stories in his history, but unfortunately, this is not one of them. This is a movie that really disappointed me because I don't remember disliking it this much the first time I watched it, mm-hmm. but this was my first real rewatch of it in a long time, and it was a very negative experience for me. I didn't like it at all. I will say the DC animated universe has turned a corner in the last year, I think, with the year and a half with the focus on the Teen Titans side of it. I feel like they got the voice casting better on those movies, and they've done a much better job of making me care about the characters. But this was a miss from DC Animation, from a studio that went about 10 years without having any misses. You know, it was, with a few here and there, like First Flight, that are divisive. But they didn't really have any just outright bad animated movies for a long time out of DC. And I thought this one qualifies to me as a bad one.
Yeah, I would agree. I've never seen this before watching it for this. So, I think this does qualify as a bad one, especially it just sucks, especially because it carries the name of something we both are so fond of, and yet mm-hmm. this is only Throne of Atlantis in name only. It only takes the most basic of plot points and adapts them. None of the real storytelling beats, none of the emotion, none of the heart, none of the nuance from the comic story translates to this, and it is a terrible adaptation as a result.
It makes the same mistakes that First Flight made, but to me, it makes them even more egregiously.
You're right.
We will revisit the DC animated universe in the future to see how it's come along. I definitely want us to do Death of Superman because I would hold that up as a direct opposite example of this. But anyway, in the meantime, did we get it wrong? Do you disagree with us? Did you like this movie, or did you find that the changes worked? Or do you agree with us that it was pretty much a turd? Send us your thoughts.
In the punch bowl of life?
In the punch bowl of life. Send us your thoughts on Twitter through gphillips8652 or at nickduke87. You can also comment on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, or you can email us, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. In the meantime, Nick, do you have any final thoughts, or should we go ahead and take that commercial break and roll that beautiful bean footage?
Bean footage it is.
Let's roll that beautiful bean footage.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here, and we want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. And in addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Oh, Baxter. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Charming.
That's me. I'm nothing if not charming.
We are back in the, at least it's out that end and not the other. We are back in the studio here. And we are ready to hit you, folks. We're trying to keep things moving along today. So we're ready to hit you with our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. We're ready to hit you with a segment we like to call The Rundown. So, where should we start today, Nick? What about on Netflix?
Yeah, what about it? You know, news this week, of course, came down that after following the cancellations of both Iron Fist and Luke Cage by Netflix, the flagship program of the Marvel Netflix universe, Daredevil, now has also been canceled. This after a season 3 that, by all indications from most people I've talked to and from reading the general reviews online, a season 3 that was a step up from season 2 and that had kind of restored the show to a more solid footing. But nonetheless, it appears that the days of Marvel programming on Netflix are coming to an end. Jessica Jones season 3 is still yet to release in sometime in 2019, as is The Punisher season 2, but all signs point to those being the final offerings from the Marvel Netflix partnership.
Yeah, this is kind of following along the lines of what a lot of people were speculating a few weeks ago when the other cancellations came down, but I think a lot of people still assumed that of all the shows, Daredevil would be safe, being, from most indications, the most watched of the Marvel Netflix shows, and one of their most watched shows, period. So, definitely a sign from Netflix that we are ready to wash our hands of Marvel. Now, as you know, Nick, I'm so far behind on the Netflix shows, going back to the first season of Iron Fist, really. So I've got so many shows to watch in front of me. But I do think that there has been, and I talked with this with some of my coworkers, that there's been a palpable decline in interest in the Marvel Netflix universe from that initial phase one, so to speak, where we had Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage even. And I think the dividing line, at least from talking to some of my friends at work or some of my coworkers, that for them it was Defenders kind of being a letdown that kind of caused them to just lose interest in the rest of the universe. And maybe that's not the case for everyone, but it does feel like the Netflix universe lost steam, and whatever the reasons may be for the conflict between Netflix and Marvel, I think it may be a case of neither party was able to be satisfied with the other in this case. I think Netflix wanted the shows to be a little tighter. I think Marvel wanted to have a little bit more creative freedom on them. And I'm pretty sure that the creators, the showrunners of the universe, expected to have more of a tie-in to the movie universe, which never came. So it just feels like one of those marriages that's kind of ending in a bit of a messy divorce.
Well, and also, you know, it can't be understated the effect of the impending Disney streaming service on this as well. I don't think Netflix is overly interested in helping to continue to build a brand that is soon to be its very direct competitor. So I think that undoubtedly played a huge role as well.
Probably so. But nonetheless, it does give you an idea that we're heading towards a finite conclusion, probably after Jessica Jones Season 3 and Punisher Season 2. So with that being said, that's not the only news in the world of comics or in the world of Marvel, because let's go to the aforementioned Marvel Cinematic Universe, which supposedly tied into the Netflix universe, but really didn't. But on the big screen, nonetheless, we got the release this week of the latest and a first official, I believe, trailer, full-length trailer for Captain Marvel, the upcoming release from Marvel Studios, telling the story of Carol Danvers back in the 90s and who she is, how she came to be, and presumably where she's been all this time. And boy, this trailer kicked ass. I mean, absolutely kicked ass.
Yeah, it was awesome. I don't really know what else to say about it. And again, this is something, these trailers, for Captain Marvel at least, I think you and I both come at it from the standpoint of having zero expectations or zero wishes for them, because we know nothing about Captain Marvel and what her deal mm-hmm. is in the comics. We haven't followed her recent surge in popularity. We don't know anything about her back in the days when she was Miss Marvel or Binary or any of that. So these are kind of an open book for us. This is mm-hmm. we're pretty much
we've not conversed with Hogan.
We have not. We're pretty much willing to go wherever they are going to take us. And thus far, it looks like they're going to take us somewhere that looks fucking awesome.
You said it perfect, Bubba. Now we should. Everything about this looks awesome. The CGI looks awesome.
Yes.
But here's the other thing about this trailer for us. I think we need to fess up to a small portion of us that takes a moment and to stop thinking about how awesome it is, and instead to once again turn our ire towards Warner Brothers, right? Mm-hmm. Because let's see, fighter pilot, who is a space cop, and ends the trailer by flying up into space, shooting blasts all around her and destroying spaceships. Let's see, could that be a Green Lantern movie, Nick? Do you think that might possibly work?
No, never.
Yeah, you're right. So Marvel is going to make the great Green Lantern movie before DC ever even touches it. So, because they screwed the pooch so bad with the first one. So that's a frustration for a diehard Green Lantern fan. But holy cow, this looks awesome. Carol looks fantastic. The costume, the Mohawk helmet being in there. Marvel embraces its comic book roots so well in these movies, and I can't wait to see how they pay it off here. Never thought I would see Skrulls on the big screen. Gonna be awesome.
Yeah, can't wait for this.
But we also got a little bit of news, or rather rumor and innuendo, Nick, more fair to say that perhaps, out of the MCU. And that is that Joe Russo, one half of the Russo brothers that are kind of the shepherds of the Marvel Universe right now from the director's chair, they say Captain America, Chris Evans, may not be done with the role just yet. Joe Russo says, I think it was more emotional for him to wrap up Avengers 4 than it was for us, mostly because he's not done yet. I don't want to explain what I mean, but audiences will soon understand. Is this misdirection, Nick, or what are you thinking about this?
I have no idea what to think about this. Is it possible that he's, you know, transitions into a more supporting role in the MCU going forward rather than making a permanent exit? Is it possible that, you know, he continues to appear via flashback or whatnot? I don't know. There's lots of different possibilities here. It is interesting, though, because of all of the core three, Evans, Hemsworth, and Downey Jr., Evans has always been the one that it seems like had more interest in moving on to do other things. He's openly talked about wanting to launch his directing career. He seems to be more, have a greater desire to take on, you know, more creatively challenging projects than he finds the Marvel movies. So of all of the three to stick around for a bit longer, to hear that he might be doing that is a bit surprising to me.
True, although we've also heard that Hemsworth wants to stick around now, so...
Yes, well, I guess what that's not overly surprising to me.
Right, but he's the one, yeah.
Of the three to stick around, well, hearing that he might do it is surprising.
I have a thought on how this might be a technicality of sorts. When you look at the Avengers movies, and you presume, I presume, that we're going to get more Avengers movies going forward... They've not hit upon one of the classic Avengers villains, who is known for time travel. The villain I'm referring to, of course, is Kang the Conqueror. Mm-hmm. What if the next big Avengers villain is Kang? And because he's a timey-wimey type villain, that would give them the opportunity to include Captain America at some point in the movie, even though he is technically dead in our timeline.
Yeah, that would certainly work, but we'll have to see if that winds up being the case.
Anyhow, moving on to our next news, PN news item. That is that Sony is already anticipating success for its Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse movie, and thus they have already signed off on plans for a sequel and an all-female spinoff movie, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Sony has tapped Voltron Legendary Defender showrunners Joaquin Dos Santos and Lauren Montgomery, both of whom are familiar names to DC animation fans, to handle the projects individually. Montgomery's would be an all-female Spider-Verse spinoff featuring Spider-Gwen, Spider-Woman, Madame Web, Spider-Girl, and Silk. Unsurprising that they're expecting success for this movie, which looks awesome, and they've tapped the right people to do it. Dos Santos, of course, has a history of animation. Lauren Montgomery has directed some of the best DC animated films to date. It looks like a good slate of movies here, Nick.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that this is already... You know, I guess I've been burned by Warner Brothers too many times to get too excited when I hear about, you know, all these grand plans being made before a movie
has even launched.
But this makes a lot of sense. I do wonder, as it relates
the
to...
The only thing it's missing is a report to leak out about the executives from Sony doing a screening and giving it a standing ovation.
The one thing I wonder is, in regards to a sequel to this movie that's coming out next week, is it going to be a true Spider-Verse sequel where we're going to do the Spider-Verse gimmick again with all the different characters? Or could it perhaps be a more Miles Morales-focused focused sequel that will give Sony the opportunity to have its own ongoing Spider-Man franchise while also ceding the live-action Spider-Man franchise to Marvel's control. Could be an interesting way for them to go about it. And Miles Morales, as I've talked to, as we've talked about before, is likely a merchandising goldmine that Sony is sitting on top of right now. So can't wait to see what comes of this franchise. Can't wait to see the movie. I should have thoughts on it. Not for next week's show, but for the following week. I'm going to an opening night screening of it.
Well, let's leave the Marvel world behind, shall we, Nick, for now? And let's move over. Go ahead and scoot your chair over, Nick. We're going to an area of this studio that we've gone to many times.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see from the end of one wall meeting with another wall,
mm-hmm.
that means that we've reached the DCEU Worlds of DC Corner.
Your name for it changes every week.
Their name for it changes every week.
Well, that's neither here nor there.
And the big news item this week is that a Blue Beetle movie is in development. Warner Brothers has hired screenwriter Gareth Dunnett-Alloser to write a Blue Beetle movie script centered on Jaime Reyes. That's according to The Wrap. In comic books, of course, everyone knows Jaime Reyes is a teenager who inherits the alien scarab that previously had been at the behest of Dan Garrett, the original Blue Beetle. Ted Kord, of course, is the second Blue Beetle, and in the New 52 series served as the mentor of sorts to Jaime Reyes, so we don't know if they'll include Ted or not in this movie. He would be DC's first Latino character in a solo movie, has been played on Smallville before, but yeah, Blue Beetle, character that I think has a lot of potential. He's a good character. I like that the fact that he has the scarab and almost is at war with himself constantly is an interesting angle. So no reason this can't succeed other than the fact that it's a Warner Brothers movie.
Yeah, and once again, an opportunity to tap into a demographic that hasn't really been catered to in terms of superhero films yet. So all kinds of diverse ground to be broken here. I think that is why I think this might actually wind up happening and not getting caught up in development hell the way many of the DC movies seem to do these days.
And Blue Beetle is another character that doesn't have to have any strong ties to other characters.
Right.
So you can do him as more of a standalone movie, and if you want to have a Ted Kord in the movie as his mentor, fine. If you don't, you don't have to. But Jaime is a strong enough character to carry a movie on his own. I've long thought he's one of the great reimagined legacy characters of DC in the last couple decades. So good move here from Warner Brothers greenlighting that. And also being greenlit is the sequel to Warner Brothers Animation's The Lego Batman Movie. The original director, Chris McKay, is working on the script right now, apparently. And Lego Batman will also be in the Lego movie, Lego 2, coming in February. But apparently we're getting a direct Lego Batman sequel. Nick, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm all for this. I thought the first one was one of the big, I wouldn't say surprises, necessarily, when it first came out last year. But it was something that I enjoyed more than I was anticipating it. I knew it would be good. I didn't think it was going to be as good as it was. So, yeah, I enjoyed that, and I'm all for a sequel, especially if it brings back Greg's favorite, Michael Cera as Robin.
Yes, the great Michael Cera, who can also be seen playing Lex Luthor in the Justice League film, I believe.
No. They're completely different individuals.
Oh, okay. Let's leave the corner, Nick. Let's get back to our normal.
Now, one location question, though, you know, they said that Lego Batman is all over the Lego movie, too, which begs the question, is Jonah Hill reprising his role as Green Lantern from the first Lego movie?
That's an excellent question. As long as it's not in live action, I'm fine with it in the context of a Lego movie. We'll have to see, Nick. We'll just have to let it play out and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of letting it play out and see where it goes, Let's move over to the comic book page from DC Comics, shall we? And let's move over to a writer who is really letting it play out and see where it goes over the course of his more than 100-issue run on Batman. And that is Tom King. Beloved fan and critic favorite Tom King has come out and revealed a few more details about his Batman run. Namely, that Batman number 60 will wrap up the post-wedding Cold Days arc. 61 to 69 is titled Nightmares with a K, described as an epic arc, scraping at the soul of Batman. And then issue 75, he says, will kick off a huge bat event with a secret name that sets us up for the end of his run at 105. No real details here, Nick, but it looks like Tom King is prepping for the close of his run, which is still quite a long ways away. As someone who's reading the series, what do you make of this? You have any predictions for some of the things that could be coming up?
Well, obviously, we got to be building to the big confrontation between not just Batman and Bane, but also Batman and the other individuals that made up Bane's group, the group of villains that were seen standing behind him at the conclusion of Batman 50, who were all in on this plot to emotionally and physically eventually break the bat in some way. So I would assume it's going to start to see Batman and Catwoman come back together and unravel the mystery behind what exactly has been happening to them. So that's what I'm betting on for 75, is the return of Catwoman to the pages of Batman.
The real question for me is, how does this all tie into Rick Grayson? Do you think that he's going to be miraculously saved from his permanent brain condition?
I don't know. He's pretty upset still. He's pretty done with the superhero life, but his muscle memory is dragging him back as we speak, I'm sure.
Dina, whose muscle memory once dragged him in to a public theater back in the early 90s.
Oh, God. What a transition. To be fair, it was an adult theater. I mean, it's like...
It was.
You know, it... Come on.
It was.
Come on.
And the muscle memory of Paul Pee Wee Herman Rubens got him in a little bit of hot water at the time. Maybe Much Ado About Nothing. He's made a comeback since then. And he's going to be making an appearance in our beloved DC CW universe coming up soon, the Arrowverse, if you will, because none other than Pee-wee Herman, by God, Nick, Pee-wee Herman will be on an episode. And I just realized it says the December 3rd episode of DC's Legends of Tomorrow, which, of course, was this week's episode, which has already aired.
It has, but we haven't talked about it, and we will talk about it on next week's show. So there you are.
That's right. Paul Rubens, Pee-wee, right?
Yeah. Huh? You guys probably liked it. Here are our thoughts next week.
Next week. Did we do good preparation for this show? That's not for you to say.
It's really not for you to say. It's not for us to say. It's not for anybody to say, quite frankly.
No.
What is good preparation? Who knows, honestly?
In any event, that's been the rundown, folks. And with the need to progress things quickly, let's move on to reading and watching. Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
Same. What you been watching?
No, lots of things. The CW things.
Oh, yeah, CW things. So, and stuff. Well, before we get to the CW things, I will mention that I caught up on The Walking Dead. AMC's The Walking Dead, sorry. And the most recent two episodes I caught leading into the mid-season break, thought they were very good. The show continues to fire on all cylinders, really, post-Rick Grimes. I find that the show has picked up steam. I think the characterizations are much better. I think the tone of the show is much better than what it has been in recent memory. There's actually some semblance of a glimmer of hope for the characters, which it feels like there hasn't been in three or four seasons at this point. I'm really enjoying the show. I thought the mid-season finale was excellent and introduced a new set of villains that, dare I say it, might actually be compelling. And the next step in Negan's character, which wasn't as face-palmingly bad as I was expecting it to be. So we'll have to see where it goes. And by we, I mean I. I'll keep you informed.
Yes, continue to keep me posted on this show that I have sworn off.
And the other show I have not caught up on, but I did watch the Jason Todd episode of Titans, which I think was three episodes ago as of this recording. And, man, color me surprised again. This show has hooked me. While there are still some things about it that I'm not in love with, I'm not in love with an F-bomb spouting Nightwing necessarily, or Dick Grayson necessarily, that being said, the show makes me buy into him. I think the acting is good on the show. I really like this version of Dick Grayson in terms of his acting and his the way he carries himself, the fact that he is a hero who can stand on his own. This version of Jason Todd was excellent. He was an annoying little shit, and it was perfect. great way of almost foreshadowing what we all know as an audience is coming for Jason, that he's going to meet a violent demise, and it's almost setting the stage for that in the future because you see the kind of path that he's on, that Batman has not made the same difference in his life that he made in Dick's life. And references to characters like Two-Face, just a continuing to build this mythology on the Titans show. I'm excited about it, man. I'm eager for you to catch up to it so we can discuss the show a little bit more. But, just a really good episode. So, dug it.
Glad to hear it. I'm planning on catching up at some point, although, let's be honest, it might be a while.
Well, speaking of it might be a while, we're 2 weeks we've gone 2 weeks now without talking about the CW shows, and I believe, I could be wrong with this, I am too far behind on Supergirl to even comment on it over that period. The last episode of Supergirl I watched, Nick, you have to help me out with this, was the one where, let me see if I remember this correctly, I think it was the one where they ended up with James Olsen kind of meeting up with the Agent of Liberty guy at a party. They killed off Mercy and Otis.
Mm.
And so that was the last episode, I think, that I saw. Supergirl had the little, like, containment suit she had to wear, and then she got free of it at the end of the episode.
Yeah, so it's been a while for you. I will just keep my thoughts very brief in that case. I continue to be a little bit higher on this season than you are. I think they are... The last couple of episodes have been doing a better job of trying to handle the political material with a bit more nuance and not be so heavy-handed about it. They've actually managed, God help me, to do some borderline interesting things with James Olsen. Brainy continues to steal every scene he's in. And they're even starting to give a little bit more purpose behind this Nia Nall character. So lots of good things going on Supergirl. Enjoying it.
Just so long as Nia doesn't start throwing work punches around, that would be it.
Well, if she were to do so, I think good old Nate Milton would come rushing to her defense.
We love the Godfather.
We do
here at the Hard Traveling Studios, and no besmirching is meant through our good natured ribbing. In any event, what's on Mondays is Arrow. Arrow is another show that comes on Mondays on the CW network, and this is a show that I am caught up on. So caught up on, in fact, that I'm too caught up on it for our show. But I will limit our discussions to the two episodes prior. And I have to be completely honest with you, Nick. The last episode of Arrow was so good that I've almost forgotten about the one before that, which was also good. So refresh me a little bit on what that one was about.
Oh, I don't know, because I'm the same way. I believe it had something to do with Laurel continuing to work Oliver's legal case and him being not overly receptive to her help. We had, you know... the
Anatoly.
The Anatoly subplot. We also have the subplot of the murdered guard at Slabside, who we were led to believe it had been the work of the Bronze Tiger, and then at the end of the episode, we kind of realize what Oliver realizes, that this spoiler alert, this weaselly little douchebag has been playing him all along, and is really just a creepy little bastard, albeit, unfortunately now, a creepy little bastard that appears to be poised to play a larger role in the series going forward.
Yes, He has. We knew that he had. We thought that he was an agent of Ricardo Diaz. Well, it turns out he's not. He's just a, as we find out, a very
essentially a serial killer is what is implied.
Serial killer. Yeah, he is. He is a creepy serial killer and very, very well played by the actor. But that leads us into undoubtedly one of the best episodes of the season to this point on the CW network.
For sure.
And probably in my opinion, an all-time level episode of Arrow, certainly in the pantheon of top 10 episodes. And that would be the Slabside Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
This was an entirely Oliver Queen focused episode, which already gives it positive marks in my book. And it is Oliver's last day in prison, basically. He's getting out. But of course, it wouldn't be Oliver Queen if everything went according to plan. And so before Oliver can escape prison, Ricardo Diaz mounts one last assault on Oliver in the prison. And it sets the stage for what is not just a great episode of Arrow, but a great standalone television episode that could stand up as its own. You know, I've seen this mentioned online, but it could stand as its own mini movie of sorts. Michael J. White on his Twitter account referred to it as an action movie / Arrow episode. And I agree with that assessment. It was spectacular from beginning to end. The performance from Stephen Amell, the performance from Michael J. White as Bronze Tiger, the redemption of Bronze Tiger over the course of this episode, the action scenes, the martial arts chicanery, the violence, the incredible performance by Kirk Acevedo as Ricardo Diaz here, just giving one of the classic villain performances on a show that has been littered historically with great villain performances. He certainly stakes his claim here. And of course, a hell of a swerve involving Oliver's little buddy during this prison arc with a creepy, scary performance. We get to see Cody Rhodes make his last stand here of sorts for now. And just a lot of great stuff in this episode, Nick. I'm going to let you talk about it because I've talked about it enough.
It was outstanding. Among, you know, I'm not typically one to comment on fight choreography and whatnot, but from a pure, fight choreography standpoint, from an action standpoint, this might be one of the best episodes of the show they've ever done.
Yes.
Large-scale assaults, typically. You know, this show has always done great one-on-one fights or been able to do great one-on-one fights, but a lot of times when it does the big-scale giant brawls, it kind of tends to lose itself. I think specifically of the god-awful finale to the Damian Dark season that we've mocked openly on the show. This is the antithesis of that. This is an outstanding mass action scene with the prison riot and the breakout and stuff. Just well done all around. And sets the stage for what should be a very interesting what is the road forward for Arrow? What is the big threat that Ollie's going to come up against now with Ricardo Diaz behind bars? It's going to be interesting. Can't wait to see where Arrow goes after the midseason break.
Absolutely. What a great season it's been to this point. Regardless of how they finish, hopefully they finish strong. But regardless, we don't need to forget what an awesome first half of a season this has been.
If you take the back, like, 8 episodes of last season and the first, like, 8 of this season, it almost builds, like, this really great mini-season in and of itself.
That would be a great way to revisit when they're all on Netflix at some point, to go back and watch from that point of last season and view it as almost the Ricardo Diaz arc, if that makes sense.
Right.
Moving on to a totally different show tonally, but no less consistent, and that is Legends of Tomorrow, which over the course of the last few weeks has been spectacular as always, beginning with an episode that takes place in 1950s Japan regarding to the creator of the Godzilla movies, where the legends go back and have to kind of wrangle this monster, this creature that has inspired these horror movies. And an outstanding episode, Nick. I think one of the best of the season, largely because it's the first time all season that Mick Rory has gotten a lot to do on the episode. It's a Mick-heavy episode, and we've talked before that he might be our favorite character on the show when he's given a chance to be. And he delivers in spades here as we learn more about his fan fiction novel. And it actually serves the legends well in this case. Just another great episode here with all the legends chipping in, but Mick is the star of the show.
Oh, absolutely. This, at least the most recent episode, not the most recent episode, but the most recent one we're discussing. Nice to see him get, you know, an episode that kind of focuses on him a little bit more, and nice to see him get a little action there towards the end of the episode and see that whatever it is that he does in the bedroom is clearly disgusting to everyone else.
Well, let me ask you the question that Mick asked of the horror director at the end. Do you think he should have gone for four boobs, or was three enough?
Oh, I would have gone for four, definitely.
Good call. I think so, too. And then it was followed up with another episode this past week that was more centered around the character of Nate and his father, as Nate's dad, who works, of course, for the government, goes with the legends on a trip to 1920s Paris, where they encounter a lot of the great artistic figures of the Roaring Twenties, whether it be Salvador Dali, whether it be Ernest Hemingway, the Fitzgeralds, and so forth. As they're hunting down a Minotaur character, or Minotaur, as the Brits call him on the show. And another fun episode, not quite as good, I thought, as the Japanese episode, but still a funny episode with some nice homages to the audience as well. Legends has gotten more meta than ever this year, and they continue that in this episode. And continue to give us great character interactions, development with various members of the cast. Not so much development, but just fun interactions and a fair, decent scene involving Sarah and Ava. So good stuff all around here.
Absolutely. Legends just continues to impress, even when it has a subpar episode. At least there's a bar of quality now that it cannot dip below. It's just incredible.
It truly is. It's not just the coolest, and it's not just the best. It, my friends, is just incredible.
Mm.
Now let's move on to Tuesday nights and The Flash. So over the past 2 weeks, what have we missed on The Flash? Well, we finally resolved Caitlin's subplot from the early part of the season, where she has been searching for her long-lost dad. Turns out that her dad is still alive, sort of, and has metahuman powers. He is a character known as the Icicle, and he encounters Team Flash, and it doesn't go necessarily the way Caitlin would like it to go. This episode surprised me, Nick, because making her step to the forefront for this episode was really good, and to have a multidimensional role in the episode was really good, and Cisco stepping in and playing another key role. I think Cisco's been underutilized this year on the show, and having him step back up again and play a major role. These two characters are part of the heart of The Flash, and I think that if Joe is missing, who is the heart and soul of the show, if he's out, they're going to need Caitlin and Cisco to step up to kind of fill that role of bringing that to the show. And they did a great job here. I enjoyed it. I loved seeing Barry sacrifice so much for his friend and want to see the good in everyone, as Barry is want to do. And just good stuff all around here, man. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it was great as well. I am... Like you, I was happy for a reprieve from Cicada, and like you, I'm also iffy on the whole Caitlin's dad subplot, so it makes me concerned that he may become more of a focus of the show in the back half of the season rather than Cicada. So I'm a little bit apprehensive on that front, but hard to complain when the Flash delivers a solid episode.
Right. And I thought the actor playing her dad did a good job of or playing Icicle, I should say, did a good job with his sort of, you know, Martin Short and Jack Frost-like appearance. Mm-hmm. So moving on to this most recent episode from last week, it was the origin of Cicada, essentially, while also a story about a new character called the Weather Witch that Barry and Nora are trying to take down. And I guess I'll touch on that aspect first. The only real remarkable part of the Weather Witch is a pretty shocking scene to me when she drops a truck on her dad and has the classic line as she says, "All right, well, thanks a lot for letting me drop a truck on my dad. See ya." And that was awesome. I thought that was great. And even though she kind of looked like a Power Rangers villain, it was a good subplot with Barry and Nora and Iris. All the family stuff's been great all year. Cicada. There's two parts to this. So, and I know your thoughts are on it are probably going to be a little bit more harsh than mine. I thought the story was really good, was really well done with Cicada. They gave him depth. They gave him, it's hard to even view him as a villain, to be honest. They gave him such a compelling and backstory and reason for his anger. It was a little sudden for
him. The prior episode, you're talking about the most recent episode of Flash still, right?
Yes, this is the episode involving Cicada and his origin.
I gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. I got the two mixed up, which is why I was confused. I thought the Caitlin thing came more recently. I don't even know where to start. The problem is they are attempting to make you view Chris Klein in a sympathetic light. And he does not have the ability to emote or carry himself in such a way that you buy him as a believable character. There is no transition shown between douchebag Chris Klein and loving uncle surrogate father Chris Klein. It just happens.
Right.
It's a lazy, in addition to being poorly acted, it's poorly written. And as a result, this whole Cicada thing, I'm over it, man. I'm ready for it to be done with. I know a lot of people are down on this season of The Flash, and I understand that, but I feel like a lot of that is because of the Cicada stuff. To me, if you took the family dynamics with Barry and Iris and Nora and attached them to any of the other recurring big bads from the previous seasons of The Flash, this
except
season,
Savitar.
Even Savitar. I am not as anti-Savitar as you are. I think Cicada is far, far worse than Savitar. For me, anyway.
Well, I do agree with you that Cicada is not a compelling villain. I think they did a little bit more in this episode to make him compelling, but still not enough. And I'm like you. I'm ready to blow through this. I'm ready to move on. Whether they're going to make the nurse lady a bigger villain, I don't know. I'm just ready to move past Cicada and on to whatever is going on in the future that Norris keeps talking about. So, yeah, I'm with you, man. Cicada is just not a compelling villain, and they need to move on as quickly as possible. Moving on to Black Lightning, I'm way behind on, so I can't help you on this one, Nick. What's going on?
Black Lightning, the two most recent episodes were among the worst of the season, in my view. We have a bizarre subplot with people hanging out in the woods who are in a literal race war, and some babies are born. And, of course, the babies, one baby, it's a twin set of babies. One baby is white and one baby is black, and it causes quite the moral dilemma for the individuals who are involved in the race war. Black Lightning, typically a show that does very well at handling political material with subtlety, not so much this time. Beats you about in the head and neck area with his message, and didn't care for it, sir.
Well, very well. I'm still behind on it. I gotta catch up on that and on Supergirl moving forward. So I will play along in so much as the three episodes that I watched. And how are you going to do this with two episodes of each? Just average them out and rank them?
I guess, yeah. Let's just average the shows out in general.
Average the shows out and rank them. Well, at the top, well, I'll start at three because I've watched three of the shows and caught up to them. At number three, I'll have The Flash. At number two, I'll have Legends of Tomorrow. And at number one, with a bullet, I've got Arrow.
Yeah, I will have Black Lightning at five. I will have Flash at four. I will have Supergirl at three. I will have Legends of Tomorrow at two. And I will have Arrow at one.
Excellent. Well, send us your CW rankings for the last 2 weeks over to our Twitter accounts. Email us or leave those on Facebook at our Place to Be Nation Comics account. Now, with all that being said, I see that on my grandfather clock on the wall here, that's right, I've suspended a grandfather clock now on the wall of my apartment. The wall's collapsing around it. We've got exactly 30 seconds. My God, we've got 30 seconds on the clock, Nick. It's the wrestling half minute. Go.
Raw sucked.
Oh, it was horrible. One of the worst episodes of Raw that I can remember, and it's been bad for quite some time now, but this is they're hitting a new level, Nick.
Indeed they are. Other things are good, though.
Yeah, SmackDown seems like it's doing well. I haven't watched it yet, but it seems like it's doing quite well. Daniel Bryan's delivering. NXT's delivering. New Japan's delivering. We got a lot of stuff going on.
Yep.
Can't say any more than that. Dynamite Kid died, so there's a thing. Oh. And, all right, that was our half minute, Nick. Can you believe it?
That's all we said is that he died. We didn't praise him.
Before people
get all up in arms. Oh, he's a terrible person. Yeah, well, so is everybody else in the wrestling business.
That's right. And we didn't bash him either.
Nope.
So people can't say, well, he was very innovative. He was, but we didn't say either one. So, you know, we're stating facts here, people. That's what we do. We're truth tellers.
We are truth tellers. Hey, before we move on completely from the wrestling thing, WrestleZone's Facebook account is asking me a question that I feel like needs to be asked of you. And that question is, what did you, Greg, think of Punishment Martinez's NXT debut?
Well, Nick, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know about Punishment Martinez's NXT debut because I haven't watched the weekly television. I can tell you I've conversed with the version of myself that was watching Ring of Honor television on occasion when he'd visit his parents' home and would see Punishment Martinez at 2 o'clock in the morning and he would put him to sleep every time he'd see him wrestle. But that's not to say that he can't have improved and he can't improve further in the NXT system, but of all of the big NXT signings in recent memory, he is the one that excites me the least. So we'll have to see what happens with regards to his development moving forward. We'll see. Let it play out and see where it goes. So with all that being said, folks, we do have a loaded month here at Aquamonth at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We haven't worked out all the details of exactly what we've got coming your way, but know that you've got at least one, maybe two long book hunters coming your way. We're going to have a special review of the Aquaman movie. We're going to try to touch on different eras of Aquaman's past, too. Some stuff that maybe we're not even familiar with. Peter David, maybe some classic stuff from the 60s we don't know yet. We're still working out the details. We're going to try to hit upon some things that maybe we haven't discussed here on the show before, and we're even going to bring in noted Aqua expert, the manager, Todd Weber, to join us for at least one of these episodes. So stay tuned to the rest of Aqua Month. Nick, any parting words for all of our wonderful listeners out there?
No, we do not. And I actually have to say, you know, we're going to close this show as we have for some time with a little musical interlude from our good old friend JR. And this one, in the keeping with this show, which has been breezy and we tried to keep it moving along, we got a short song this week for him. Those of you who know me in real life know that this week, well, I celebrated my 31st birthday. So I think good old JR wants to wish me well on the day of my birth. So JR, take it away.
Well, let me see if I can get Mr. Ross in here. Jim, are you here?
Baker Mayfield. Kyler Mertens. Boomers. I apologize. Not off there for a minute. Well, yes, it's Nick Duke's birthday. Everybody give a hand for Nick Duke. Good job, Nick Duke. You're a good man, Nick Duke. You've done a hell of a lot in your life. Not as much as me, not as much as Watts, not as much as Austin. You've done a fair amount, though. So I'm going to sing for you, and I want everybody listening at home, I want you to think about your loved ones. I want you to think about maybe when you were a child and somebody would gather around you, maybe in a sombrero with a little guitar thingy, and they'd sing to you on your birthday. Maybe they'd sing something, sound a little bit something like this. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Nick Duke. Well, happy birthday to you. That's all I got for you, folks.
I believe it was quite sudden, and thank you.
Our traveling fanboys.